A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's personal. He and Hannah just finished moving apartments with their one-year-old son. No family nearby to help. The to-do list is bottomless. Taxes, apartment paperwork, work, unpacking. And he's noticed something. His instinct is to work around the clock, push through the backlog until it's gone. Hannah's instinct is to maintain equilibrium, not burn out. Daniel suspects his ADHD is part of the equation. When there's more to do than he can hold in his working memory, working non-stop becomes a substitute for having an actual task-tracking system. The work itself becomes the system. He wants to escape that cycle, and he's asking how to externalize progress tracking so the backlog stops having a hold on him. So where do we even start with this?
We start by naming what's actually happening here, because Daniel just described something I've seen clinically more times than I can count. He's not just working hard, he's using overwork as a cognitive prosthetic. The continuous doing is standing in for a system his brain can't maintain on its own, and the tragedy is that it works just well enough to feel necessary while quietly degrading the exact capacity he needs to escape it.
The quiet part is what gets me. Nobody tells you that working harder can make the backlog worse. It feels like the only responsible thing to do.
That's because the feeling is so visceral. When your working memory is overloaded, and with ADHD, that threshold is lower and the overflow happens faster. The brain treats that sensation almost like pain. Something is wrong. You need to act. The problem is that the action the brain reaches for is continuous doing, not structured planning. Because structured planning requires the very working memory capacity that's already underwater.
The brain's emergency response is to bypass the thing that would actually help.
And this isn't a willpower failure, it's a documented cognitive difference. Under stress, the ADHD working memory, what researchers sometimes call the mental whiteboard, fills up faster and overflows more easily than in neurotypical brains. Items don't just get added, they jostle each other. Things fall off. The whiteboard gets erased mid-sentence, so the brain develops a workaround. If I just keep moving, keep executing, keep doing, I don't need to hold everything at once. The doing becomes the memory.
Which is what Daniel called it. The task tracking system becomes the working focus. The system is the task, not the tracker of tasks.
That distinction is everything. A real task tracking system sits outside you. It doesn't care if you're tired, it doesn't degrade at hour 7, it holds the same list at 11 p.m. that it held at 9 a.m. But when the system is your own sustained attention on the work, it's only as reliable as your current cognitive state. And cognitive state, it turns out, has a pretty hard expiration date.
This is where the cortisol research comes in, right? The 4 to 6 hour cliff.
There's solid research showing that sustained cognitive effort beyond 4 to 6 hours substantially reduces decision-making capacity and cognitive flexibility. Your ability to prioritize, to distinguish urgent from important, to switch strategies when something isn't working, all of that degrades, so you're working longer but making worse decisions about what to work on. And with ADHD, you're starting from a position of reduced working memory capacity to begin with. The cliff isn't just steeper, you hit it sooner and fall harder.
The person working 12-hour days to clear the backlog is, by hour 7, probably creating more backlog than they're clearing. They're just too cognitively depleted to notice.
There's a study from the Journal of Attention Disorders in 2023 that quantify part of this. ADHD adults under high workload reported 40% higher rates of task switching without completion. That's not marginal. That's the difference between finishing 3 things and finishing 2, consistently, across a day, a week, a move. And every unfinished task switch reinforces the backlog feeling. You touched 5 things and completed none of them. The whiteboard just got more crowded.
The substitute system is actively making the problem it's supposed to solve worse. That's the burnout paradox.
That's exactly what it is. The overwork approach feels like progress because it provides constant feedback. You are doing something, there's motion, boxes are being unpacked. But the metacognitive step, stepping back and asking what actually needs to happen and in what order, never occurs, because that step requires pausing the doing, and pausing feels like failing when the backlog is screaming at you.
Let's ground this in Daniel's actual situation, because the moving apartment scenario is almost a perfect case study. You've got physical tasks, unpacking boxes, assembling furniture, and you've got administrative tasks, taxes, apartment paperwork, work deadlines. The physical tasks give immediate feedback. You open a box, you empty it, the box is gone. The administrative tasks require cognitive bandwidth. You need to sit down, gather documents, think through forms. If you spend all day unpacking boxes, by 8 p.m. your decision-making capacity is shot. But the taxes don't care. They're still there. And now you're too depleted to handle them.
The next day you wake up and the taxes are still there, plus new boxes, plus the guilt of not having done the taxes, which takes up its own space on the mental whiteboard. The backlog grew while you were sleeping. That's the feeling Daniel is describing. It's never ending because the system he's using can't actually reduce the backlog. It can only shuffle items around.
Let's talk about the other pole, Hannah's approach. The equilibrium approach. Because Daniel called it the probably healthier response, and I think he's right, but I also think it has its own hidden cost that nobody talks about.
It absolutely does. The equilibrium approach preserves decision-making capacity. By not burning through cognitive resources on unsustainable work hours, you maintain the ability to prioritize, to see the big picture, to handle the taxes when they need handling. But the cost is that it can feel like not doing enough. When your partner is unpacking boxes at 10 p.m. and you're going to bed because you know you need to be functional tomorrow, there's a guilt there, a sense that you're not pulling your weight.
From the overworker's side, there's resentment. I'm killing myself here and you're maintaining equilibrium. It looks like indifference.
This is where couples get into real trouble during high-stress periods. Both people are coping in ways that make sense for their brains, but the coping styles are invisible to each other. The overworker sees the equilibrium keeper as checked out. The equilibrium keeper sees the overworker as creating chaos, burning out, making things worse, and neither is entirely wrong.
The first thing to say to Daniel is, you and Hannah are both responding rationally to an irrational situation. The problem isn't either of your coping styles. The problem is that the situation, more tasks than two humans can complete, while also parenting a one-year-old, requires a system that neither of you currently has.
The system needs to do one thing above all else, externalize the backlog so thoroughly that it stops being a feeling and becomes a list. Because a list doesn't get heavier at hour 7, a list doesn't degrade. A list can be shared, negotiated, prioritized. A feeling can't.
This is where I want to push on something Daniel said. He framed it as wanting to learn the secret of accepting that you might have more on your plate than you have bandwidth to get through.
Say more about that.
Acceptance without a system is just giving up. If I tell myself I accept that I can't get everything done, but I have no external way to know what I'm getting done, what I've deferred, what's waiting, then acceptance isn't a strategic choice. It's just surrender with a nicer name. The acceptance only works if you can look at something concrete and say, that's on the list for Thursday, not today, and I know I'll get to it Thursday because the system won't let me forget.
This is the acceptance paradox. You can only truly accept limits when you have a system you trust. Without external tracking, acceptance feels like failure because you have no guarantee the deferred task won't simply vanish into the fog. With external tracking, acceptance becomes a strategic choice. You're not ignoring the task, you're scheduling it.
The real question isn't how to accept the backlog. It's how to build a system that makes acceptance possible.
For ADHD brains specifically, the system needs to be almost embarrassingly simple. Not because the person isn't smart enough for a complex system, but because complex systems require working memory to maintain, and working memory is exactly what's compromised here. The system has to be dumber than you are on your worst day.
The system has external hard drive. It works even when you don't.
That's the standard. If your system requires you to remember to use the system, it's not a system. It's another task on the whiteboard.
Alright, so let's build this. What does the externalization actually look like for someone in Daniel's situation?
There are three practices that have genuine research backing, and they build on each other. The first is what's called a brain dump. Every morning, 5 minutes, write down everything in your head, every task, every worry, every I should remember to. A 2024 study on ADHD and journaling found that this alone, just the act of externalizing what's in working memory, reduces feelings of overwhelm by roughly 30%.
30% from 5 minutes of writing things down. That's an enormous return on almost no investment.
The mechanism makes sense when you think about it. The overwhelm isn't coming from the tasks themselves. It's coming from the cognitive load of trying to hold them all simultaneously. The brain dump moves them from working memory to paper. They're still there. They still need doing. But your brain is no longer the storage medium.
Paper doesn't get tired.
Paper is the most reliable cognitive prosthetic ever invented. But the brain dump is just step one. Step two is the three-task rule. Only three things can be active at any given time. Everything else goes on a waiting list. Not a to-do list you'll get to later. A waiting list. Explicitly not active. Because three is roughly what an overloaded ADHD working memory can track without the system collapsing. It's also enough to feel like progress without being so many that nothing gets finished. The rule forces prioritization. You have to look at the brain dump and pick three. Those three are the only things you're allowed to feel responsible for today. Everything else is on the waiting list, and the waiting list is not your problem until tomorrow's three-task selection.
The waiting list is doing the emotional work of permission. It's saying, these tasks exist, they're captured, they won't be lost, and you are explicitly not working on them right now.
That's the key. The permission is built into the structure. You don't have to generate it through willpower. The system generates it for you.
For Daniel and Hannah, this becomes especially powerful because they can share it. A shared external system, a whiteboard on the kitchen wall, a shared digital list, makes the division of labor visible and negotiable. It turns the who's doing more argument into a what needs to happen next conversation.
The visibility is everything. When the backlog lives in two separate heads with two different coping styles, it's invisible to the other person. Hannah can't see the list that's screaming at Daniel. Daniel can't see that Hannah has already handled three administrative tasks that never even made it onto his mental whiteboard because they were done before he noticed them. A shared system makes the invisible visible.
It also prevents the thing where both people are doing the same category of work, both unpacking, both doing physical tasks, while the administrative stuff sits untouched because each assumes the other will get to it, or neither has the cognitive bandwidth to even notice it's still pending.
The shared system also lets them negotiate explicitly. We have three active slots today. What are they? If taxes need to be one of them, who's taking it? If unpacking the kitchen is another, who's taking that? The negotiation becomes concrete instead of atmospheric.
Atmospheric is a good word for it. The backlog as weather. It just hangs there.
Weather you can't do anything about. A list you can.
Let's talk about the third practice, because I think it's the one that counterintuitively does the most psychological work. The done list.
Tracking completions, not just to-dos. At the end of the day, you write down what you actually finished, not what you worked on, what you completed.
This matters for ADHD brains in particular, because the dopamine system responds to completion, not effort. You can work for 12 hours, and if nothing feels finished, your brain registers the day as a failure. The done list forces you to notice the completions that your working memory already discarded.
Working memory is terrible at holding successes. It's optimized for threats and unfinished business. The done list compensates for that bias. You look at it at the end of the day and you see, I filed the change of address form. I unpacked three boxes. I called the electrician. Those things were on the whiteboard this morning and now they're not. Your brain won't remind you of that. The list will.
Over time, the done list builds a counter-narrative to the backlog feeling. The backlog says you're falling behind. The done list says you've completed 47 things this week. Both are true. But only one of them gets automatic airtime in your head.
There's a case study I think about a lot. Software engineer with ADHD, working 12-hour days, constantly behind, constantly exhausted. He switched to a physical Kanban board, three columns to do, doing, done. The board became his working memory. He didn't have to hold anything. The board held it. His hours dropped from 12 to 8, and his output, measured in completed tasks, increased by 20%.
20% more output in two-thirds the time. That's not a productivity hack. That's a structural change in how work gets processed.
Because he stopped using his brain as the system. The board was the system. His brain got to do what brains are actually good at, thinking about one thing at a time, instead of what brains are terrible at, being a database.
That 12-to-8 shift matters for another reason. He got 4 hours of his life back. 4 hours that weren't spent in the degraded decision-making zone where he was probably generating more rework than progress.
The reward point is underappreciated. When you're cognitively depleted, you make mistakes. You unpack a box into the wrong room and have to move it later. You fill out a form wrong and have to redo it. You forget where you put the screwdriver and spend 20 minutes looking for it. All of that is work created by the overwork approach. It's not just that you're less efficient, you're actively creating new tasks.
The moving scenario is full of these. You assemble a bookshelf at 11 p.m. You're exhausted. You put a panel on backwards. Now you have to disassemble and reassemble. That's an hour of work that wouldn't exist if you'd stopped at 8 and done it tomorrow morning when your spatial reasoning was functional.
The tragedy is that the overworker interprets that rework as evidence that they need to work even harder. The bookshelf took longer than expected, so I'm even further behind, so I need to push even more. It's a spiral.
Let's address the thing Daniel asked directly. How do you escape the cycle? What's the actual sequence?
The sequence is, externalize first, prioritize second, limit third. You can't skip to limiting your hours if you haven't externalized, because limiting hours without a trusted system just feels like negligence. The system has to come first. Morning brain dump. Everything out of your head and onto something outside you.
I think for someone in the middle of a move, the brain dump might take 10 minutes the first time. That's fine. The backlog is real. It's going to be a long list. The point isn't to have a short list. The point is to have the list somewhere other than your frontal lobe.
Then the three-task rule. From that long list, pick three things that are active today. If you finish them, you could pick more. But you start with three. And the waiting list, everything else, is visible. It's not ignored. It's deferred.
This is where Daniel and Hannah can do something that actually addresses the relationship dynamic too. They can sit down together, look at the brain dump, and decide together what the three active tasks are. That conversation alone, just the act of jointly deciding what matters today, can diffuse a lot of the atmospheric resentment.
Because it makes explicit what was previously assumed. Daniel might assume the taxes are the most urgent thing. Hannah might assume getting the kitchen functional is the most urgent thing. Neither is wrong. But if they don't have that conversation, each is silently judging the other for not working on what they think is the priority.
The one-year-old is the wild card in all of this. Parenting a toddler means your available hours are unpredictable. You might plan to do three things and only get to one because the baby had a bad night. The system has to handle that without collapsing into guilt.
That's where the done list becomes essential. On a day when you only got one thing done because parenting took everything, the done list still shows that one thing. And it also shows, if you're honest about it, that parenting was the other thing that got done. Keeping a small human alive and fed and comforted is not nothing. It belongs on the done list.
The done list as reality check. The backlog feeling says you accomplished nothing. The done list says you kept a human alive and filed the change of address. That's a real day.
The three-task rule adapts to this. On a hard parenting day, maybe the three active tasks are keep the baby alive, eat something yourself, and one administrative thing. That's a legitimate three. The system doesn't judge, it just holds.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the system needing to be dumber than you are on your worst day. What does that rule out?
It rules out most apps, honestly. If you have to open an app, navigate to the right view, remember the tagging system, and type things in, on your worst day you won't. The barrier is too high. A physical whiteboard on the wall has zero barrier. You walk past it, you see it, you add to it with a marker. A piece of paper on the kitchen table has zero barrier. The system has to be so simple that using it is easier than not using it.
The whiteboard also has the advantage of being public. Daniel and Hannah can both see it. It's not in anyone's phone. It's not in anyone's head. It's on the wall.
There's something about the physical act of erasing a completed task that digital systems don't replicate. The dopamine hit of wiping a thing off the board. It's small, but it's real. And for ADHD brains, those small dopamine hits are fuel.
Let's step back and talk about what this looks like over time, because I think the first week of implementing this is going to feel wrong. The overwork instinct doesn't just disappear because you put up a whiteboard.
The first week is hard because you're fighting the substitute system. Your brain has learned that continuous work is how you manage anxiety about the backlog. When you stop working at 8 p.m. and there are still things on the waiting list, your brain is going to scream at you. That's withdrawal from a coping mechanism, not evidence that the new system is failing.
You have to expect the discomfort and not interpret it as a signal to abandon the system.
The discomfort is the point. The substitute system was numbing the discomfort of the backlog by keeping you in constant motion. The new system lets you feel the discomfort and teaches you that the discomfort is survivable. The list will still be there tomorrow. Nothing catastrophic happens between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m.
Over weeks, the done list starts to accumulate evidence. You can see that things are getting done. The backlog is shrinking. Not because you worked harder, but because you worked on the right things at the right time with a functional brain.
The taxes don't get filed because you spent your best hours unpacking decorative items. The equilibrium approach with an external system reverses that. Your best hours go to the things that actually need your best hours.
The secret Daniel is looking for. The secret of accepting that you might have more on your plate than you have bandwidth to get through. It's not an attitude adjustment. It's infrastructure. Build the system, and the acceptance follows.
The system has to be shared. Daniel and Hannah are in this together. The backlog is a joint problem. The system should be a joint solution. When both people can see the full picture, the resentment dynamics start to dissolve because there's no hidden labor, no invisible effort, no unspoken assumptions about who should be doing what.
Let's make this concrete with three things Daniel can do tomorrow.
First, the cognitive offload habit. Tomorrow morning, before anything else, 5 minutes with a piece of paper. Write down everything in your head, every task, every worry, every nagging thought about what needs to happen. Don't organize it. Don't prioritize it. Just get it out. Do this every morning. The 2024 study showed roughly 30% reduction in overwhelm from this alone.
Second, the three active tasks rule. From that brain dump, pick three things, and only three, that are active today. Everything else goes on a waiting list. The waiting list is visible. It's not ignored. But you are not responsible for it today. If you finish the three, you can pull more from the waiting list. But you start with three.
Third, for Daniel and Hannah specifically, create a shared external system. A whiteboard on the wall, a piece of paper on the kitchen table, something both of you can see and add to. Make the backlog visible to both of you. Have a 2-minute check-in each morning where you decide together what the three active tasks are. This turns the who's doing more argument into a what needs to happen next conversation.
The meta lesson underneath all of this, the goal isn't to clear the backlog. The goal is to have a system you trust so much that the backlog doesn't live in your head anymore. That's the real secret to accepting limits. The backlog exists. It will always exist to some degree. But it doesn't have to live in your working memory, degrading your decisions and burning you out. It can live on a whiteboard, or a piece of paper, or a shared list. Somewhere outside you. Somewhere that doesn't get tired.
The opposite of burnout isn't rest. It's a system you trust.
That's the line. That's the thing to sit with.
It's not just abstract. It's testable. If you have a system you trust, you can stop working at 8 p.m. and not spend the next 3 hours mentally reviewing everything you didn't do. If you don't have a system you trust, stopping at 8 p.m. feels like negligence because you have no guarantee any of it will be remembered tomorrow.
The question Daniel might ask himself is, do I trust my current system? And if the answer is no, and it sounds like it is, what would it take to build one I do trust?
The answer is almost always something simpler than you think you need, something outside your head, and something shared with the person you're in the trenches with.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The term serac, referring to a towering block of glacial ice, comes from a Swiss-French word for a type of crumbly white cheese, because early Renaissance mountaineers thought the ice formations looked like cheese wheels.
Glacial ice got named after cheese.
I'm never going to look at a glacier the same way.
What if the feeling of never enough isn't a signal to work harder, but a signal to build a better system? That's the question to leave with. As AI tools for task management keep improving, voice-to-list, automatic prioritization, all of that, the barrier to externalizing is going to drop. But the psychological shift, the part where you trust the system over your own sense of urgency, that's going to remain the hard part. The technology can give you the tool, it can't give you the trust. That you have to build, One day of using the system and surviving the discomfort, until the done list is long enough that your brain finally believes it.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Or just put up a whiteboard and write it down. We'll find it eventually.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.